Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Hitler, Part 1. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. Stay tuned at the end of this episode for a podcast update and to find out what we've been up to and what we have coming up. This is part one of a three-part series. We tend to see Adolf Hitler as a force of nature who turned the wheels of history, one evil act after another. We view him as some sort of cold mastermind who was able to turn an entire nation into a factory of death and a war machine. A wicked despot hell-bent on forcing his bigoted worldview on billions of others, no matter what the cost. And whilst all of this may be true, what we often don't learn about Hitler is that he was a profoundly strange person. Like, really strange. At least by our average standards. Now, I'm not a big proponent on what's normal and what is considered weird, as I feel that everyone has unique traits to them, and we're all individuals. But I feel the picture we all have of Adolf Hitler can only be complete by knowing what he was like off the world stage, and in privacy. Now, it's not unusual for dictators to have somewhat idiosyncratic traits. They are all known to have their foibles and quirks. But I think Hitler might take first place for history's strangest tyrant, a man who was obsessed with health and hygiene, whilst at the same time taking obscure concoctions of amphetamines and bull semen daily. A man who was troubled by a flatulent stomach, which could make a room so foul-smelling that his inner circle would complain. Hitler refused to shake bare hands for fear of germs, and carried a vial of pure alcohol around with him to disinfect any areas of his person that came into contact with others. Hitler was someone who, on the surface, seemed completely uninterested in women. But he would go on to have such destructive relationships with them that every woman he was romantically entangled with would ultimately end their own life. He was a man who was profoundly shy and quiet, but nonetheless took the stage and captivated millions, rocking history in the process. In tonight's episode, I'm going to peel back the mythos that surrounds Adolf Hitler and take a stark and honest look at the man, warts and all. Adolf Hitler was born in Austria in 1889. Young Adolf, known affectionately as Adi to his mother, had a relatively quiet childhood. He suffered some abuse from his father, Alois, but historians disagree on how severe this actually was. It was also relatively standard practice and behaviours from fathers at the time, although not to excuse this, of course. Adolf would later write that as a child, he deeply feared his father, whilst at the same time his mother Clara was the complete opposite, doting, affectionate, and indulgent. This made Adolf somewhat of a mother's boy, seemingly soft to his peers. This background would set the stage for what is arguably the weirdest thing about Hitler, his personal relationships, or the lack thereof. During the First World War, Hitler would serve on the front line, but he struggled to make friends with his comrades. He was constantly seen as the odd man out. It didn't help that whilst the other soldiers guzzled beer, smoked tobacco, and frequented brothels, 25-year-old Adolf preferred to sketch, draw, or read political pamphlets. He was a deeply quiet and introspective fellow. Now, of course, this isn't in itself problematic. There's nothing wrong with self-control and introversion. But you could say that it was unusual for an early 20th century soldier to avoid alcohol, cigarettes and women. Very few others did at the time, and this was part of what made him feel a bit of a loner during the First World War. Soldiers often use alcohol in particular as escapism, a small relief from the horrors around them. Drugs too. This introspection would be a feeling that never actually left him. Later, we will discuss how he will go on to overcompensate for the feeling of being left out. Because there is a theme that runs throughout Hitler's life, and has left a big question mark in the endless books about him. You see, sexually speaking, Hitler is a total enigma, which makes him quite unlike the average person, and most tellingly, very unlike other dictators. Stalin was a known serial womanizer in his younger years, fathering several children from different mothers. But then he became almost completely abstinent and monk-like after taking power in the 1930s. Mao Zedong was the other way around, slightly less successful in his younger years, but once he gained power, he indulged in this voracious appetite for women, famously taking a plate of Hong Xiao Ru and a virgin to bed every night. Of course, this was nearly always exploitative in the process. Benito Mussolini too was a well-documented womanizer who had a long history of mistresses and casual affairs, both before and after he took power. Mussolini boasted to friends and colleagues that he had a voracious sexual appetite, at one point even claiming to have had 14 women all at once. He married twice and maintained numerous mistresses and casual liaisons throughout the years. Il Duce certainly took advantage of his position of power. Hitler, on the other hand, well, who actually knew? There has been lots of rumours about depraved interests or abusive tastes over the decades since Hitler's fall from power, but these are just rumours. Nothing about this part of his life has ever really been confirmed, at least not by people with first-hand knowledge. This has led some to comment that he may have been asexual, or being a germaphobe, he may have had a fear or distaste about the sexual process itself. Either way, this fastidiousness was enough to raise some eyebrows, especially amongst another of his contemporary dictators, specifically Benito Mussolini, who in almost stereotypical Italian fashion was, as we mentioned, very much a sexual stallion. Stallion, yes. Although, much like Mao, exploitation was often the reason for his impressive number of very, very young mistresses. In any case, in the 1930s, the two men actually met in Rome to discuss the future of fascism in Europe. Mussolini had always seen Hitler as a bit of a prude. Then he suddenly came across a delicious morsel of confidential information. It had been reported that in the early hours of the morning, the Führer had called for a woman to be sent to his bedchamber. This little detail delighted Mussolini, who now finally had proof that the Führer was a man just like any other, and with the same appetites. Mussolini was savouring in this moment. "Not so pious now, are you?" he thought. But as it would actually transpire, Hitler had actually called the lady up with other things in mind. He was to give a speech the next day, and was fussing with the way his shirt had been ironed. The lady came to his room, re-ironed his shirt, starched the collar, and was briskly sent away again. Mussolini found this revelation deflating and once again found Hitler impossible to read. None of this in itself is problematic behaviour, of course. There's nothing wrong with this, but it does reveal something of Hitler's unusual character. Whereas others might be enjoying the perks of power, Hitler was busy obsessing over his personal appearance all the way into the dead of night. But, uninterested as he may have been, this feeling did not go both ways. When Hitler was detained in Landsberg prison, after the failed Beer Hall Putsch of 1923, he had managed to garner himself a respectable collection of groupies, so to speak. These were women who were charmed by his antics and took to him, bachelor as he was, with squealing adulation. In Landsberg prison, Hitler enjoyed relative freedom, despite being a prisoner, and he was even allowed to have visitors to his own private room. It would have been all too easy to have a Fräulein over to pass the time. However, the only thing that actually ever got past the prison bars were the love letters. Oh, and one other thing. Hitler loved to receive pastries, baked with love, from home, and sent in to lift his spirits. It was ultimately no more than flour, sugar, and butter that Hitler would truly indulge in. That was his limit. Adding, of course, a bit of podge to his previously slender, undernourished frame. This would make Adolf Hitler one of the few prisoners in human history to have actually gained weight during his time in captivity. But hey, there are perks to any job, I suppose. I'll talk more about Hitler's time in prison in the next episode, however. Nonetheless, it wasn't as though the man was incapable of noticing the opposite sex. But there would be only woe and misery to those who actually caught Hitler's eye. A few years after being released from Landsberg prison, Hitler grew attached to his half-niece, Angela Gelli Rubal. In 1929, Gelli, who was just 19 at the time, and referred to by Vanity Fair as Hitler's, quote, doomed angel, moved into Hitler's Munich apartment. The Führer would have been around 40 years old at the time. Quite the age gap. Nonetheless, Hitler became smitten by her, and the two had an incredibly intimate relationship. There is a big question mark about whether this became more than just familial love, but Hitler certainly acted like more than just a doting uncle. The relationship broke down before relatively quickly, however, as Hitler began to obsessively control every aspect of Gelli's life. What she wore, who she saw, and even when she was allowed to leave the apartment. Hitler, who was twice her age, was bizarrely besotted by her. The younger girl was desperate for some relief from the obsessed and somewhat abusive uncle. But in the end, Gelli could take no more, and she tragically shot herself in the chest at the age of just 23, 4 years after moving in with Hitler. Or so the official story goes. It was Hitler's gun which was found beside Gelli's body. The future Führer had the whole crime scene wrapped up quickly to avoid any outrage or public scrutiny, and any suspicion of foul play on his part. Even so, the Frankische Tagespost, a Nuremberg socialist newspaper, reported less than 48 hours after her body was discovered, the incident as, quote, a mysterious darkness surrounds the death of this unusual beauty. The Nazis would eventually ban the Frankische Tagespost and destroy the paper's inventory. Its editors were taken to the Dachau concentration camp, although this was unrelated to the story they printed about Gelli, of course. The whole experience is said to have stuck with Hitler, and he never really got over the loss of Gelli. Even if it had never been a proper relationship, or it was him that was responsible for driving her to this extreme end. Either way, lessons were not learned. On his part. Rumors circulated in Munich for many years that Gelli's death was not actually a suicide. Fritz Gerlich fiercely believed this. Gerlich was a journalist and editor of the Münchner Neuesten Nachrichten newspaper. He was fiercely anti-Nazi and against the mass anti-Semitism that was sweeping the country. He simply wouldn't let Gelli's mysterious death lie. He firmly believed that Hitler had murdered Gelli, and that if the world knew the truth about this crime, it might be saved from far worse crimes to come. If only he really knew. Gerlich continued to pursue the story courageously until it would eventually cost him his life. In March 1933, just as he was about to publish the results of his investigation, a squad of stormtroopers broke into his newspaper office, beat him, seized and burned his manuscripts, and dragged him off to prison. Gerlich was eventually moved to Dachau concentration camp, where he was executed in July of 1934, during the Night of the Long Knives. The rumours which carried so much water and drove Gerlich's investigation was that Kelly's nose was broken upon discovery of her body, suggesting a violent quarrel had occurred before her death. After all, why would Kelly need to break her own nose before shooting herself in her own chest? There was little sense to be made of her body's condition. Further speculation persisted that Kelly was pregnant at the time, with rumours that she was carrying either Hitler's child or the child of a Jewish music teacher. Many people from the area and who knew Kelly believed that a pregnancy announcement was the cause of her final, perhaps fatal, quarrel with Hitler. Ernst Hanferstangl, an American-educated art book publisher and confidant of Hitler in the early Munich years, was a somewhat cosmopolitan and sophisticated observer of Hitler's Caligula court of bizarre characters. Hanferstangl, who was the creator of the Nazi Sieg Heil salute, took an extreme dislike to Kelly and called her, quote, an empty-headed little slut with the coarse sort of bloom of a servant girl. Charming. Hanferstangl, who later fled to the US and became a consultant on Hitler to FDR, claimed that Hitler displayed an adolescent infatuation with Kelly. It was quite pathetic, he said. She, however, was not as interested in him. She betrayed him with his chauffeur and also with a Jewish art teacher from Linz. Hanferstangl added that while Kelly was perfectly content to preen herself in her fine clothes, she certainly never gave any impression of reciprocating Hitler's twisted tenderness. Hanferstangl stated that he once observed Hitler and Kelly at the opera, saw him, quote, mooning at her, and then when Hitler noticed Hanferstangl observing him, he quickly switched his face to the Napoleonic look. FYI, in this context, mooning refers to spending a lot of time daydreaming or thinking about a person that you are infatuated with in a way that can seem silly or unproductive. Not baring your naked ass at them. Hitler's second public relationship, this time with Eva Braun, would also end the same way, although under very different circumstances. Although the relationship was public at the time of their death, this too was kept secret from the world for more than 14 years, with Braun attempting suicide twice prior to her successful attempt due to neglect from a cold and distant Hitler. Eva Braun eventually took her own life just a few moments before Hitler did so himself in 1945, towards the end of the war, as the Russian Red Army had encircled Berlin, where Hitler was trapped. This meant that both of his intimate relationships ended in suicidal tragedy, a grim reminder of the deep personal darkness behind the public monster. Hitler also had a brief relationship with Maria Reitzer in the 1920s when she was just 16. He called her Mimi. After he broke off the liaison, she attempted to hang herself. According to Reitzer's own account, the 37-year-old Hitler became friendly with the 16-year-old girl, grooming her before she was asked out by him. Hitler met Reitzer when she was working in a shop in Ober-Salzburg in 1927. At the end of the evening, he made a coarse sexual advance towards her, which she rejected, but he did coerce her into kissing him. They had a number of other dates during which Hitler was increasingly emotionally manipulative. According to an interview that Reitzer gave before her death in 1992, Hitler told her that he wanted her to be his wife, to found a family with her, to have blonde children. But at that moment, he had not had the time to think about such things. Repeatedly, Hitler spoke of his duty and his mission. He told her to wait for him and that they would live together eventually. After this declaration, however, Hitler ignored her and broke up the liaison. There are various theories and pieces of evidence to support Hitler's relationship and sexual dysfunctions. But perhaps some of the more scientifically valid are that, firstly, recent DNA analysis of blood taken from the sofa where Hitler shot himself suggests that he likely suffered from Kallmann syndrome, a rare genetic disorder. This condition is associated with delayed or absent puberty, low testosterone, and cryptorchidism, known in layman's terms as undescended testicles, which could contribute to low libido and developmental issues, physically and psychologically. This tends to lend establishing credence to the British popular wartime propaganda song titled, quote, Hitler has only got one ball. You will probably remember it from middle school. Well, this song was actually based on medical records from his 1923 prison stay, which confirmed that he had right-sided cryptorchidism, an undescended testicle, further supporting the recent tests on his blood work. In addition, wartime psychological analysis commissioned by the US Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor of the CIA, suggested that Hitler was an impotent coprophile and masochist. These reports, which included graphic accounts from his close associates, are often seen as wartime propaganda, though similar claims continued to persist after the war. Some current psychological examination of historic data and medical records leads to theories that Hitler was fundamentally asexual or potentially emotionally stunted. It's argued that he may have repressed his sexuality, potentially leading to his preference for younger, more submissive women, and his general inability to form close emotional bonds. This theory, in particular, is arrived at purely on speculation from modern-day psychological subjection. Siobhan Mulcahy, an investigative reporter for the Irish Examiner and CrimeMagazine.com, spent 2 years investigating the personal life of Adolf Hitler. During her research, she discovered that the German dictator liked young Catholic convent schoolgirls, in addition to having many homosexual partners over the years. During his childhood, Mulcahy wrote, Hitler was often beaten viciously by his father Alois and adored by his gentle mother, who tried to protect him from his father's whip and belt. Hitler later said in Mein Kampf that his fondest childhood memories were of, quote, sleeping alone with his mother in the big bed, while his father was away at work. For most of his life, Hitler was predominantly homosexual, Mulcahy uncovered, something which looked very different in the 1920s through 40s than it does today. In his teens and early 20s, he had a string of exclusive male companions, including August Kubizek, Reinhold Hanisch, and Rudolf Hausler. He also shared accommodation with these men in seedy Viennese or Munich backstreets and in homes for the destitute. From the outset of the First World War, Hitler enjoyed a sexual relationship with fellow dispatch runner Ernst Schmidt, which lasted almost 6 years. Hitler is also believed to have had sexual relations with a senior officer at the time, too. United States intelligence later discovered that Hitler was never promoted during World War I due to his sexual orientation, and records also show that he was arrested in Munich in 1919 for pederasty and theft. Former Nazi Otto Strasser said that when Hitler became Nazi Party leader in 1921, quote, his personal bodyguards and chauffeurs were almost exclusively homosexual. Two of these bodyguards in particular, Ulrich Graf and Christian Weber, were expected to satisfy their boss's needs whenever necessary, whatever those needs may be. Then in 1924, when Hitler was jailed for treason in Landsberg prison, he began a relationship with Rudolf Hess, who was nicknamed Fräulein Anna and Black Emma by other top Nazis. Their sexual relationship lasted on and off for many years until Hess, who was prone to hysterics and extreme emotions, became an embarrassment to the Nazi leader. These homosexual relationships are, however, the subject of much debate, and many credible historians believe that they are the work of US and British propaganda from the Second World War. Though some witnesses and Nazi survivors well into the 1980s did substantiate several of the rumors. The Guardian newspaper reported that multiple eyewitness accounts from Hitler's inside circle, in addition to various surviving historical documents, reveal Hitler's secret double life. The respected German historian Lothar Machtan claims in his 2001 book titled Hitler's Secret that the Führer ordered the deaths of several high-ranking Nazis in order to prevent the secret of his sexuality from surfacing. Ernst Röhm, the leader of Hitler's Sturmabteilung, or Stormtroopers, tried to blackmail Hitler by threatening to reveal his sexuality. Rome, who was also openly gay, was murdered as a result, according to Mactan, himself a history professor at Bremen University. But let's take a look at something other than Hitler's relationships. Let's look at his politics. You see, one of the lesser known stories is how Hitler actually got into politics in the first place. It's pretty interesting. You will likely know that he joined the German Workers' Party before climbing the ranks and morphing it into the National Socialist Party with himself at the helm. But what many don't know is how Hitler actually found this party after the end of the First World War. You see, Germany's newly established Weimar Republic was incredibly unstable at the time. It was being attacked on all sides by political extremism and civil violence. Having lost the Great War and facing international humiliation, the German society was very fragile. A lot of different parties and groups had ideas about how the future of Germany should look, and many wanted to install their own ideology by force, if necessary, at an incredibly hostile and turbulent time. Hitler joined up as an intelligence officer during this period, and he was originally sent to spy on the German Workers' Party to see if they posed a threat to this fledgling state. Despite being sent to keep tabs on this unruly group, Hitler decided to join it, and he turned a potential threat into an actual disaster. I think it's painfully ironic that the state sent Hitler to control the future of this party, and then Hitler used this party to control the future of the state. Hitler's political affiliation came later in life, and although he is remembered primarily as a fierce and captivated public speaker, able to enthrall and adulate the crowd, this wasn't always the case. Remember that during the First World War, Hitler was quiet and withdrawn, and this too was also true of his early speeches. He was actually pretty woeful on stage, at least at first, but after some religiously applied practice, he quickly improved. Hitler spent hours, days, and even weeks practicing his speeches, leaving nothing to chance, obsessing over the message that he wished to deliver. He was focus-driven and in the zone, like perhaps no other individual in Germany with sights set on high political office was. Hitler would rehearse not just his script or the tone of the delivery, but every last detail, even down to his facial expressions and the hand gestures that he used at certain points during the speech, leading to some truly bizarre photographs emerging from the time. Hitler also had some beliefs about the world that were just outright bizarre, no matter how you frame them. You see, some believed in God and others were purely materialistic about the world. But Hitler walked somewhere in the middle ground, sort of mixed up with paganism and folklore. Much of his inner circle was subscribed to the occult and esoteric beliefs and practices too. We'll go into more detail about Hitler and the occult in episode 3 of this series. But perhaps most famously was Hitler's extremely close confidant Rudolf Hess, who believed in divination and even tried for a long time to find ways to levitate. Heinrich Himmler, who had an obsession with the Norse god Odin, the Holy Grail and numerous other occult interests. The so-called Germanic spiritualism would even affect Hitler's performance on the world stage, returning once more to Benito Mussolini. Because when the two were discussing politics one evening in 1940, Hitler told the Italian dictator that he was, quote, mystically and scientifically convinced of being possessed not by a demon or by a god, but by a spirit from Aryan mythological prehistory. Mussolini would later comment that this statement left him utterly disorientated. Now, I know that these two characters are responsible for some of the darkest moments of the 20th century and have forever stained human history with blood and tragedy. But good God, I cannot help but be more than slightly amused by the relationship between these two men. Two men which would significantly alter the course of world history, who absolutely did not understand a single thing about each other. They were utterly dependent on one another throughout the Second World War, yet despite the constant meetings and exchanges, these two men have absolutely nothing in common with each other, other than the shared politics of hatred and fascism. But even then, they had totally different interpretations as to what fascism actually was. The two men constantly competed with one another, rambling in broken German about women or Aryan mythology, both completely incompetent in their own ways, talking past one another and over one another, equally baffled by the other. And yet, despite their ridiculous personal antics together, they were able to somehow hold all of Europe hostage for more than half a decade. Anyway, that's enough about politics for now. Let's discuss hobbies and foibles to once again drive home just how strange the German Führer was. Firstly, it's now common knowledge that Hitler loved animals. Firstly, doting on his German shepherd named Blondie. Well, until that is, he killed him in order to test the lethality of cyanide tablets. But his love for animals would go so far that he would even declare himself vegetarian, eating simple meals like porridge and buckwheat, while his officers munched on rich and plentiful feasts of meat. But behind closed doors, and despite his public displays of abstentiousness, Hitler was known to sneak a bratwurst or two here or there. Or if feeling especially extravagant, he would enjoy his favourite, Le Bucknuddel soup, which was pork dumplings made with added beef liver in a clear and bland vegetable broth. So yes, in his own way, even Hitler wasn't immune to the pleasures of the flesh, so to speak. Many, of course, also know that Hitler was refused entry to art school and was a passionate painter during his younger years. Now, I'm no art critic, but many others, with a trained eye, have commented that Hitler's paintings can be pretty solid, though he struggles to paint people in a compelling way, suggesting his deep-seated disinterest in others. Other pre-war critics have been less generous of Hitler's paintings. In 1936, American journalist John Gunther wrote that his paintings were utterly devoid of rhythm, colour, feeling, or spiritual imagination. It's no wonder that Vienna professors told him to go to architectural school instead and give up fine art. Now, we know, and previously mentioned, that Hitler hated germs and was obsessed with cleanliness and his health. This obsession was exploited by quack doctors which surrounded him, who would keep him dosed up on pharmacies worth of drugs, stimulants, relaxants, and various mind-altering substances. This understandably began to take a toll on his physical and mental health, and by the end of the war, he was pretty strung out for most of his time awake. Hitler also disliked early mornings. Now, sure, most of us like a lie-in, so you could ask, is this worth even mentioning? But yes, I think it is. You see, Hitler hated early mornings so much that on D-Day, when the Allies swept onto the beaches of France on the 6th of June 1944, none of Hitler's staff would dare wake him to deliver the news. The Nazis actually became aware of the invasion at about 4 a.m. that day, but it wouldn't be until around 10 a.m. that the Führer would rise and hear of the news, by which point the Allies had already secured the beachheads and were bringing in reinforcements. General Alfred Jodl would later defend the decision not to wake Hitler prematurely, saying that the Führer must be in good spirits and in a good mood to make clear decisions. Coward. But even though Hitler disliked germs and early mornings and liked animals and art, Hitler had one other interest, especially in his later years. Hitler loved the sound of his own voice. You see, Hitler would go on to hold monologues during dinner parties, which could last for several hours at a time, and those attending were obliged to indulge him. The man who was once left out and ignored during the period of the First World War was now the centre of attention and head of the clique. This wouldn't have been too bad for those involved. I mean, we've all had to share a meal with a boss or a relative who dominates the conversation. Nothing new there. But there was one thing about Hitler that made these evenings a bit of an issue. Hitler's stomach. Hitler was incredibly, and unfortunately, flatulent, often creating a bit, a lot, of a stink for his guests. This may have been the real reason for his plain diet, rather than any ethical concerns about eating meat, of course. Hitler's secretary, Gertrude Junger, would go on to say that his digestive issues could make meetings quite unbearable for those in the room. Albert Speer would also later say that Hitler's flatulence, quote, affected all those nearby and turned stomachs. Anyway, that's Hitler, isolated, neurotic, self-absorbed, and quite strange. His quirks and eccentricities are just part of him being human, sure. But Hitler's are almost comical, especially for one of the most feared men in history. The flatulence, the indulgence for the pastries, the awkward mirror poses, and none of this is what made him dangerous. The truth is, it's the cult of personality, the propaganda machine, that made Hitler seem larger than life and made him able to do the unthinkable. But if you strip that away, you don't find a demonic genius. You find a petty, paranoid, awkward man. And maybe that's the one small comfort from studying history. Because, in the end, the myths crumble, and even the man who was once the most powerful in the world is just, well, painfully human. Tonight, we wanted to talk about some of Hitler's eccentricities. We didn't want to inflate the myth of fear around the man, but simply touch on the areas that are rarely touched upon. I hope we have achieved that, or at least started to achieve it. Because in part 2, we will talk about Mein Kampf and Hitler's worldview. Then in part 3, we'll discuss Hitler and the occult. So stick with us for those. Also, if you haven't already, please join up to our Patreon over at www.patreon.com/deadsouls. It costs just $2, and for that you will get access to a ton of new episodes, research materials, and blog posts. We will also be sharing some of our real-life team investigations over there, with the first one of those dropping this week. So come on over. And for those of you who have already joined, as always, thank you so much. Your support means the world to us, and it's what keeps us doing what we do. Thank you. Finally, we mentioned at the start that we would be sharing some podcast updates and news with you all. Well, we've been pretty quiet for a few weeks, you may have noticed. This is due to various reasons, but namely, a pretty intense investigation which we have been conducting, but also some huge developments in regards to a fairly large profile historic true crime case, which we have been quietly involved and supporting with behind the scenes. Following our Hitler trilogy, we aim to share the details surrounding that case, and share some exclusive and significant information and developments which no other podcast or documentary has access to. Keep an eye out for that one. Hitler Part 2 will drop next week, but there will be another episode before then, and also some Patreon content too. Good night, everyone.